I need to make something absolutely clear right up front. This presentation is intended to shock you. Over the next 90 minutes or so, you and I will confront events in which untold thousands of men, women, and children, even infants, become the victims of what can only be described as premeditated mass murder. The atrocities described in these stories showcase human behavior at what might very well be an all-time low. Yet for some reason, a rather sizable portion of the world's population has chosen to view these stories with a surprising level of indifference, and in many cases, even respect and praise. Despite these attitudes, there's no doubt in my mind that were we able to travel back in time and witness firsthand even a few seconds of one of these events, that we would emerge from the experience feeling something far more profound than simple indifference. So just where do we find these stories? Do we find them in the histories of Nazi Germany, Stalin's Russia, or perhaps one of the Crusades? Well, think again. These bloody tales come to us straight out of the pages of what is without a doubt the all-time best-selling, most highly respected and beloved book on the planet, the Holy Bible. That's right. The very same book that gave us the Golden Rule and the Sermon on the Mount also treats us to stories in which women and children are literally ripped to pieces by the swords of battle-hardened warriors. As violent and shocking as these stories are, however, perhaps most shocking of all is the fact that the Bible makes it absolutely clear to us that those who did the actual killing of these women and children were doing God's will. According to the Bible, those who did the actual killing of these women and children were acting righteously. According to the Bible, these were the good guys. I don't know about you, but I find all this a bit alarming. After all, the notion that God would command his people to kill children goes against pretty much everything most people have been taught to believe about God and the Bible. I dare say that most of us were taught that the Bible is a fundamental source of all that is good and just, the perfect moral blueprint. Heck, we've even nicknamed it the Good Book. And this presumption of biblical goodness is reinforced throughout our society at almost every turn. I mean, think about it. Even the President of the United States takes his oath of office with one hand planted firmly on a copy of the Bible. In light of these prevailing attitudes, what I had to say in these presentations is bound to come across as harsh, perhaps even unbelievable. But then, I'm not asking you to accept anything on my word alone. I want you to consider the facts, and then decide for yourself. And that's really what these presentations are all about. Bringing to your attention some easily verifiable biblical facts that, for whatever reason, may have never come to your attention in the past, and as a consequence, never even had a chance to factor into your present feelings about the Bible. In this first presentation, you and I are going to take a look at 10 stories from the Old Testament. These 10 stories reveal a God who turns out to be anything but the kind and loving fatherly figure to whom most of us were taught to pray as children. What we find instead is a God who, rather than loving his human creations as one might hope and expect, instead, repeatedly and even enthusiastically, orchestrates their violent destruction. Incidentally, these 10 stories by no means represent an exhaustive account of this kind of Bible story. Trust me, there are plenty of other stories, every bit as nasty as these, many of which we'll visit in later presentations. The 10 stories we examine here, however, provide a good introduction. So let's begin. Story number 1, the Golden Calf Party, Exodus chapter 32. Our first story is one you might actually be familiar with, and that's because it was portrayed in the popular movie The Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, you may recall, was the Cecil B. DeMille epic in which Charlton Heston played the part of Moses and Yul Brynner the part of the Egyptian pharaoh. As we will see, however, Mr. DeMille's movie alters some very important elements of the story as we find them in Scripture, and these alterations leave a person with an impression of the story very different from the one we find in the pages of the Bible. The story to which I refer is that of Israel and the Golden Calf, and you can read about it in the Old Testament book of Exodus, chapter 32. A little background first. A few chapters back, in Exodus 24, the Lord had summoned Moses to the top of Mount Sinai for a visit that was to last 40 days and 40 nights. You might recall that it was during this extended visit that Moses received the two stone tablets upon which were engraved the Ten Commandments. Now, by the time we get to Exodus 32, we learn that near the end of this visit, the Israelites, waiting in the camp below, have begun to grow restless. And understandably so. I mean, after all, Moses has been gone for 40 days. That's nearly 6 weeks. That's a long time for a person to be missing in a desert. It was during this period of uncertainty that many of the Israelites decided that it was time to forget about Moses, who's probably dead anyway, and take matters into their own hands. But they didn't stop there. The people also decided that it was time to forget about their old God and to get themselves a nice, shiny new one. To help bring this about, they enlisted the talents of a man named Aaron. Aaron constructed for the people a god made out of gold and molded into the shape of a calf. Now Aaron, you should be aware, was Moses' brother and Israel's high priest, and was the last person you would expect to see getting caught up in this god-making business. Nevertheless, Aaron made the golden calf, and the people bowed themselves before it in worship. They offered sacrifices to their new god, and they showed it every respect and honor they had previously reserved for the god of Moses. Finally, the Israelites threw a great big party, and here they ate, sang, and danced in honor of their new god. Seemingly unaware this whole time that God, the real God, knew exactly what was taking place in the camp below, and that Moses was very much alive. Now, I need to pause for just a moment to point out a rather disturbing discrepancy between the way Mr. DeMille tells the story in his movie and what we find in the Bible. This discrepancy concerns the sacrifices the Israelites were making to the golden calf. You see, according to the Bible, specifically Exodus 32, verse 6, these sacrifices consisted of burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. And according to Leviticus chapters 1 and 3, these sacrifices required the killing of animals. Animals. In other words, according to the Bible, the Israelites made animal sacrifices to their new god, just as they had made animal sacrifices to their old god. Now, in stunning contrast with this biblical account, Mr. DeMille's movie has the Israelites making, or attempting to make, a human sacrifice. Now, maybe I'm just out of touch with conventional morality here, but I dare say that there's a rather material difference between an animal sacrifice and a human sacrifice. Be that as it may, Mr. DeMille's movie treats us to a scene in which a mob of crazed Israelites are about to sacrifice to this golden calf, not a lamb or a pigeon or some other animal, but a human being. Specifically, a beautiful young virgin girl. Oh, high drama to be sure. But it's not how the Bible tells the story. You see, in the Bible, there's no mention of any violence being done on Israel's part. At least not against humans. Israel's nonviolence notwithstanding, in Exodus 32, verse 10, we learn that God was so incensed by this golden calf incident that he was prepared to destroy the entire nation of Israel. Just kill them all. And raise up in their place a new nation through Moses. And God's genocidal plans might have become a reality had Moses not, at the very last minute, intervened on Israel's behalf and talked God out of it. Whatever compassion Moses may have had for the Israelites, however, appears to have been short-lived. For upon returning to the camp, Moses sees the golden calf, and he sees the Israelites singing and dancing to its honor. Furious, Moses orders the golden calf to be burned and ground into powder. He then scatters the ashes over water and makes the Israelites drink it. Moses then makes his way to the entrance of the camp, and it is here that he gives the Israelites this now famous ultimatum. He tells them, "Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me." A group known as the Levites are the first to arrive at Moses' side, and it's to this zealous group that Moses gives the following command. Starting with verse 27, we read, quote, "Then he said to them, This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother, friend, and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Unquote. Curiously, this part of the story does not make it into Mr. DeMille's movie. Oh, and I guess I can understand why he left it out. I mean, after all, a scene depicting an army of Levites hacking to death members of their very own families might not sit too well with an audience that typically associates love, mercy, and family values with the God of the Bible. And let's face it, wholesale massacre is not the kind of thing most people want to be confronted with on Christmas and Easter, the two holidays on which this American classic typically airs. The movie The Ten Commandments offers a textbook example of how our widely held presumption of biblical goodness is reinforced and perpetuated. For here we have an extremely popular movie that blatantly misrepresents the facts in order to cater to a popular, albeit erroneous, perception of the Bible. In his movie, Mr. DeMille actually fabricates a situation, this human sacrifice, in order to make God appear justified in punishing the Israelites as harshly as he did. And Mr. DeMille's tampering with the truth doesn't stop there. If you've seen the movie, you may recall that God's punishment takes the form of an earthquake, in which the ground opens up and swallows several people. Here the role of executioner has been given over to the earth, a bunch of dirt and rocks, an impersonal killer at best. But once again, that's not how the Bible tells the story. You see, in the Bible, God commands the Levites, a group of living, breathing human beings, just like you and me, to draw their swords and to begin butchering members of their own families. I think most people will agree with me that there is a huge moral difference between an earthquake taking the life of a person who's just been caught in the act of sacrificing someone's daughter and someone decapitating a member of his own family over what essentially amounts to a change of religion. Yet these gross fabrications are exactly what we find in this very popular movie. And the fact that Mr. DeMille can actually get away with such a thing speaks volumes about just how ill-informed the general public is when it comes to the world's most popular book. Oh, and before I forget, if the slaughter of 3,000 nonviolent individuals wasn't punishment enough, the Lord also struck the people with a plague. A plague that no doubt took the lives of many more of God's chosen people. And all because during a time of great confusion and uncertainty, the people dared to worship another god and throw a party. At least that's how the Bible tells the story. Story number two, the destruction of Heshbon, Deuteronomy chapter 2. If you're a person who's chosen to believe in the Bible, yet finds the mass murder of women and children a bit difficult to stomach, well, I'm afraid I've got some bad news for you. And that's because this brand of wholesale slaughter is pretty much business as usual in the Old Testament. This simple yet harsh fact will become abundantly clear over the next hour or so. Consider, for example, our next story, that of Israel's encounter with the people living in the land of Heshbon. We find this story in Deuteronomy chapter 2. To set the stage for this story, recall from your Sunday school days that 40 years passed from the time the Israelites left the land of Egypt, in what the Bible refers to as the Exodus, to the time they entered and occupied the promised land of Canaan. You might also recall that during that 40-year period, the Israelites wandered through the desert with their leader Moses. At some point near the end of this 40-year period, the Israelites set up camp near a place called Heshbon. Now you need to be aware that back in Old Testament times, having the Israelites move in next door was kind of like having the Hell's Angels ride into town. Only a whole lot worse. You see, the Israelites had this nasty habit of killing just about everybody they came in contact with. Heshbon is just one example of this. In this particular story, Israel approaches Heshbon's king, a man by the name of Sihon, and they ask Sihon if they might pass through his country on their way to the Promised Land. For some reason, though, Sihon refuses them passage. In fact, not only does Sihon refuse them passage, but he also gathers his troops to battle against them. Well, this was a big mistake. As you might imagine, Sihon's army was no match for God and the Israelites. This is made clear in Deuteronomy 2, verse 33, which reads, quote, "The Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down, together with his sons and his whole army," unquote. Now, had the Israelites limited their killing to wiping out Sihon's army, one could reasonably argue that they acted as any nation would that had to defend itself. But it seems that God had much more than defense in mind when he gave the people of Heshbon over to the Israelites. Listen to what Moses tells us in verse 34. Quote, "At that time we took all of Sihon's towns, and we completely destroyed them, men, women, and children. We left no survivors." Unquote. Now, killing soldiers in battle to defend one's home and country is one thing. But how can anyone defend the intentional mass killing of women and children? I've heard some Bible scholars suggest that God's reason for commanding his people to kill women and children, as he did here at Heshbon, was because it would have been a logistical nightmare to take them along as prisoners. Now, personally, I find this theory less than convincing. For even if you could toss aside every last shred of humanity you possess, the theory fails when you consider the fact that Israel did possess the logistical wherewithal to carry off their victims' loot. In verse 35, Moses tells us, quote, "But the livestock and the plunder from the towns we had captured, we carried off for ourselves." Unquote. Now, isn't that nice? Plenty of room for gold and silver, cows and goats, but not for women and children. Better to just kill them. I've also heard it suggested that the women and children were killed because if the young children were to learn later in life about the murders of their families, presumably from their mothers, they might attempt to settle the score. Thus, they presented a security risk. Now, the problem I have with this theory is that there are just too many places in the Old Testament where God's decision to kill or to spare a particular group of people is clearly based on something other than national defense or security. Take, for example, the story we find in the book of Numbers, chapter 31. In this story, the Israelites attack a group of people known as the Midianites. In this story, men, women, and children are mowed down by the thousands. But Israel doesn't kill all the Midianites. 32,000 virgin girls are allowed to live. Rather than kill these girls, Moses gives 16,000 of them to the Israelite soldiers, the very same Israelite soldiers who have just finished slaughtering these girls' families. The other 16,000 are given to the priests. I'm not sure which fate would be worse, but here's my point. If ever there were a group of people on the planet who felt they had a score to settle with the Israelites, it's got to be these 32,000 virgins. I mean, think about this. These poor girls saw their entire families butchered. Then, as if that wasn't bad enough, they were given over like a bunch of raw meat to the very men who'd committed these atrocities in the first place. Now there is a security risk, because if anyone had good reason to teach their kids to hate Israel, and perhaps someday get even, it was these 32,000 virgins. Yet they were spared. In the case of Heshbon, no one was spared, not even a virgin. What these two theories really represent is a lame attempt on the part of so-called Bible scholars to justify an act of genocide. They are defending the indefensible. It's really that simple. And you can almost see these learned men squirming in their seats as they try to convince you and me, and probably themselves, that the thugs who murdered these women and children were the good guys. It's truly pitiful. Finally, consider that any attempt to justify these killings in a rational sense goes right out the window when we ask ourselves the obvious question. That being, why didn't the Israelites simply avoid Heshbon altogether? I mean, for crying out loud, walk around the place, take a different route, turn around and go back. Anything. I can't imagine this being too great an inconvenience to a group of people who have been wandering around in a desert for the last 40 years. Story number 3, the destruction of Bashan. Deuteronomy chapter 3. We're now in Deuteronomy chapter 3, and Israel is still wandering through the desert. In fact, their swords are still dripping with the blood of Heshbon's people when they wander up to their next victims. These unfortunate souls happen to be the citizens of Bashan, a land ruled by a king named Og. Now, the Bible gives every indication that the massacre at Bashan was much larger than the one at Heshbon. For example, in Deuteronomy 3, verse 4, we learn that Og's kingdom consisted of 60 well-fortified cities, as well as, quote, "a great many unwalled villages," unquote. But while the size of Israel's conquest may have changed, their method of conquest did not. The Bible makes this clear in verse 5, which reads, quote, "We completely destroyed them, as we had done with Sihon, king of Heshbon, destroying every city, men, women, and children." Unquote. 60 well-fortified cities. 60. 60. As well as a great many unwalled villages. Their inhabitants completely and utterly destroyed. Another act of genocide. As devastating as the massacres of Heshbon and Bashan were, the destruction of these two kingdoms was only a taste of the violence to come. Later in Deuteronomy 3, Moses explains to his successor Joshua that the destruction of these two kingdoms would be typical of the violence the Israelites would rain down upon the people who were then occupying Canaan, Israel's promised land. Israel's conquest of Canaan is next on our list of Bible stories. Before we look at that story, though, I think we need to pause for a much-needed reality check. We need to take a couple of minutes and really zero in on exactly what it is that the Bible has been telling us. I'll get right to the point. The Bible is telling us, in no uncertain terms, that God ordered his people to kill children. Let me say that one more time. The Holy Bible, the good book, that perfect moral blueprint, is telling us that God ordered his people to kill children. I find that absolutely mind-boggling. You know, I remember from my days in Sunday school things like, "Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so." I mean, I remember all that touchy-feely crap. What I don't remember is God ordering his people to kill children. And the reason I don't remember is really quite simple. I was never told that God ordered his people to kill children. For some reason, they left those parts out. You've probably figured out by now that we are not going to leave those parts out here. In fact, we're going to confront them in all their twisted brutality. We're going to confront the blood and the guts. We're going to confront the facts. You see, if a person wants to believe in the Bible, that's his business. It's my business, however, to help that person more fully understand exactly what it is that he's getting himself into. Think about this. When an individual embraces the Bible as a true and good book, that individual is aligning himself with the likes of Moses and Joshua and other Bible characters. And what good Christian or Jewish person wouldn't be proud to ally himself with these Bible heroes? Given this allegiance, however, one can only logically deduce that if the Bible believer of today had been born a few thousand years ago, and if that same Bible believer had been under the command of someone like Moses or Joshua, that he would have participated in these acts of genocide right along with the rest of Israel. In other words, had one of these biblical big shots ordered our Bible believer to kill old women, children, and babies, he would have done it. Certainly many of our modern-day religious leaders would have done it. People like Billy Graham, Pat Robertson, and Jerry Falwell would have done it. Wouldn't they? I mean, after all, these are men who have devoted their entire adult lives to promoting the Holy Bible as the inerrant Word of God. If these high-profile Bible thumpers are going to walk their talk, I can only assume that they would have not only been amongst the killers, but that they would have been amongst the most enthusiastic of the killers. Try to picture that one in your mind. Billy Graham, Pat Robertson, and Jerry Falwell, swords in hand, hacking their way through crowds of women and children. Crazy, you say? Yeah, you bet it's crazy. That's my whole point. To really drive this point home, though, let's you and me try something. Pretend for just a moment that you've just been thrust back in time about 3,500 years. You're no longer the person you are today, but instead are a soldier in Moses' army. What's more, you're a soldier in Moses' army during the destruction of Bashan, and you've just been given the order by Moses himself to kill all of Bashan's women and children. Just close your eyes for a minute and put yourself in the middle of this scene. You're standing there, clad in heavy armor. Your sword is drawn, and you're ready to kill. Only those you've been commanded to kill are a bunch of women and kids. There's even a rather large number of babies in the crowd. And yes, Moses wants you to kill them too. Now, assuming that you still possess at least some shred of humanity, you're probably wondering to yourself about now just how on earth you're going to get through this ordeal. I mean, how do you psych yourself up for something like this? Now, granted, these women and children deserve to die. After all, God did will this. It says so right there in the Bible. Even so, being the kind and loving servant of God that you no doubt are, I can only assume that you would want their deaths to be as quick and painless as possible. Right? Well, of course. Let's consider some of the ways this might best be accomplished. Without a doubt, chopping off your victim's head would be the quickest and most humane way to kill him, or her, although this method does have its drawbacks. For starters, you can't count on your victim to just sit there and let you whack off its head. You're going to have to find some way to keep that person from moving around. Now, if it's a child you're dealing with, you could probably just pin that child against the ground or some other stationary object with your foot. If you were struggling with a very small child, you might be able to hold that child still with one hand. You could certainly do it with an infant. Heck, infants would be easy. But the older kids and the women are going to have to be tied up or held down if you're going to opt for chopping off their heads. Now, this is very important. You see, losing leverage might result in a less than perfect blow of your sword. That, in turn, might result in a less than fatal wound, and that, in turn, would result in more pain and suffering to your victim. Something that you, as a caring servant of the Lord, want to avoid if at all possible. And besides, you've got an awful lot of people to kill. No point in taking three or four sloppy whacks when one good clean one will do the trick. What it really boils down to here is compassion. You see, you don't want to come across as being cruel, because you're not. You just want to chop off your victim's head. When you stop and think about it, you're really doing him a favor, and hopefully he'll understand this. I mean, after all, if you wanted to be a jerk about this, you could chop off his arms and legs and make him flop around on the ground for a while. But you're not going to do that because you're one of the good guys. You're one of God's chosen people. And whether your victim appreciates it or not, you truly care about him. And you can only hope that he'll understand that this is every bit as difficult for you as it is for him. Or her. Of course, if you're really having trouble getting through this, you might want to consider enlisting the aid of a partner, a sort of buddy system, if you will. Under this system, you and your partner could alternate duties. One time your buddy could hold down the little girl or boy while you chopped off its head. The next time you could switch. Be creative. You could also provide each other with that much-needed moral support and encouragement. Come on, Caleb, you can do it. Let's count together. 3, 2, 1. Thwack! There are other things to consider. For example, with so many people to kill, you probably aren't going to have the luxury of taking your victims one by one into a closed room and killing them away from the view of others. This means that you're faced with the very real possibility of having to chop off a child's head right there in front of his parents, or vice versa. Once again, you're faced with this nagging compassion issue. As a soldier in Israel, you probably have kids of your own, so it's only natural that you would feel some empathy for these parents. You know that seeing their children hacked to pieces before their very eyes would likely put those parents in a state of extreme emotional distress. And while you know in your heart of hearts that decapitating the youngster is the will of God, and is therefore the right thing to do, you can also appreciate the fact that this mode of execution is a fairly traumatic event to behold. Perhaps the best way to survive this ordeal would be to just charge to the crowd, swinging your sword as wildly and quickly as possible. Careful, though. If you charge to the crowd waving that heavy sword, you risk slipping on the slurry of blood and body parts that no doubt covers the ground and landing square on your butt. How embarrassing. You'll no doubt find yourself on the receiving end of a number of tasteless jokes told around the evening dinner table. In light of these many challenges, perhaps your best course of action is to just kill whoever's handy, regardless of who might be watching, and just keep reminding yourself that you're only doing God's work. Anyway, how would you confront such a challenge? How would you psych yourself up to take part in an act of godly genocide? How would you, using your own two hands and perhaps a sword, beat the life out of a little child? I ask this only because if you truly believe in the Bible, as so many people today claim, and had you been born back in the days of Moses, this is exactly the kind of thing you would have been up against. Oh, and I shudder to think of the consequences that would have befallen you had you refused to participate. You would have no doubt found yourself on the receiving end of an Israelite stoning. My intention in dragging you through this absurd little scenario was not to gross you out. I don't want to make you sick. I want to make you think. And think about this. We're talking about stories here that would be labeled obscene and might even be banned were we to find them in any other book. Imagine the public's response to a video game that contained this kind of violence. Yet because these horrific stories are found within the sacred covers of the Holy Bible, they have effectively been granted an exemption from nearly all rational scrutiny. By blindly embracing the Bible, our society gives tacit endorsement to stories in which mass murder and looting are celebrated as acts of righteousness. How far into the depths of moral depravity has a society sunk when it can equate the willful murder of children with virtue? I urge you to think for yourself, to be your own judge. If you find yourself confronted with an idea or a teaching or a story, and you honestly disagree with a thing, don't be afraid to admit that, especially to yourself. Please, do not embrace an idea or a teaching or a story just because it's popular. Do not abandon your ability to judge good from bad, right from wrong, just because everyone around you has. And do not let others, no matter how well-intentioned they may appear to be, make up your mind for you. Be honest with yourself and decide for yourself. With that in mind, let's put your independent moral judgment to the test and turn our attention to what is without a doubt the most misrepresented episode of mass murder the world has ever known. Story number 4, The Conquest of Canaan, the Book of Joshua. I have an assignment for you. I want you to go to your nearest video store and rent the movie The Ten Commandments. That's right, the same Ten Commandments we talked about back in story number 1. Anyway, take the movie home, pop it in your VCR or DVD, fast forward all the way to the very last scene of the movie, and then watch that scene. I'm serious, do this. You need to see this with your own two eyes. What you'll find is Moses, played by Charlton Heston, standing on Mount Nebo, counseling some of the Israelite leaders as to how the people are to conduct themselves upon entering the Promised Land. In what turns out to be the final words spoken in this four-hour epic, Moses stretches forth his arms and declares to those assembled, "Go, proclaim liberty throughout all the lands, to all the inhabitants thereof." And with these words, the music rises in its final crescendo, the camera aims heavenward, and this motion picture classic comes to its triumphant end. Now, to a largely American viewing audience, these feel-good words could have just as easily been spoken by Thomas Jefferson, Martin Luther King Jr., or, heck, Ronald Reagan. The words clearly leave a person with a mental image of Israelites strolling peacefully into their promised land, no doubt eager to share with their new neighbors the good news of the gospel, or liberty, as Charlton Heston puts it. There's only one problem with this version of the story. It's utterly false. If we accept the biblical account as true and accurate, then Israel's conquest of Canaan, i.e. the Promised Land, was easily the most devastating episode of religiously motivated mass murder the world has ever known. The number killed reaches well into the multi-millions. In fact, we have to look to modern world wars to find parallels in the destruction of human life. Israel's conquest of Canaan represented the fulfillment of a promise God had made to the prophet Abraham hundreds of years earlier. Referring to the land of Canaan, God tells Abraham in Genesis 12, verse 7, quote, "To your offspring I will give this land," unquote. In fulfillment of this prophecy, Joshua and the Israelites enter their new land, and essentially kill everyone they can get their hands on. They kill men and women, boys and girls, old people and babies. They even kill the animals when ordered to do so, although they typically kept their victims' flocks and other valuables for themselves. One thing is for sure. They most definitely did not proclaim liberty to all the inhabitants thereof. Moses provides us with an overview of the upcoming conquest in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Starting in verse 1, we read, quote, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you, and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy." Unquote. Now these verses reveal two very important features of the conquest. The first has to do with the nature of the conquest. In no uncertain terms, Israel's conquest of Canaan was going to be violent in the extreme. It was going to require the wholesale massacre of those people then living in the Promised Land. There were to be no peace treaties, no proclamations of liberty, no church picnics, only destruction. In a word, genocide. The second important feature has to do with the magnitude of this genocide. Deuteronomy 7 verse 1 states that each of the seven nations then occupying Canaan was larger than the nation of Israel. Now, how much larger, the Bible doesn't say. Still, if we assume that each of these seven nations was merely the same size as Israel, then we can make some conservative estimates as to just how large a body count we might be dealing with here. Let's do that. First, we need to get a feel for the size of Israel's population. In the book of Numbers, chapter 26, verse 51, we're told that about this time, the total number of Israelite males, age 20 and older, was just over 600,000. Now, in addition to these 600,000 males, age 20 and older, there would also be males, age 19 and younger, and females of all ages. Based upon these figures, many Bible scholars have estimated Israel's total population at this time to be somewhere between 2 and 3 million. Now, if we assume the lower estimate, that Israel's population was 2 million, then the number of people targeted for extermination would have been, at a minimum, 14 million people. You see how that works? That's seven nations times 2 million per nation equals 14 million. 14 million. Now, if we take the higher estimate and assume Israel's population was 3 million, then the number of condemned jumps to 21 million. How many people is 21 million? 21 million is the population of Texas. Imagine killing everyone in the state of Texas with swords. This is effectively what God was commanding his people to do. So much for numbers. Let's see if we can put a face on some of these numbers by examining a specific episode of the conquest. The fall of Jericho, as told in Joshua chapter 6. Now Jericho was an ancient city known for its great walls. Walls so large and impressive that entire houses were built on them. Jericho also happened to be the first of many Promised Land cities on Israel's hit list. But unlike many of their other conquests, the Israelites didn't simply wander into Jericho one day and kill everybody. It seems that God wanted to toy with the people a bit first, and then kill them. Allow me to explain. 7 days prior to Jericho's destruction, Joshua instructed the Israelite army to march completely around the city. Joining the army were seven Israelite priests, who sounded seven trumpets. The marching Israelites also carried with them the infamous Ark of the Lord's Covenant. This gesture alone no doubt sent a message to the people of Jericho that a great deal of bloodshed was just around the corner. So the Israelites paraded around Jericho, blowing their trumpets and showcasing the Ark, until they had made their way completely around the city. Having circled the city one time, Joshua then ordered the marchers to return to camp where they retired for the day. That was the routine, and the Israelites kept up this routine for 6 days. But then day seven arrives, and the routine changes. On the seventh day, Joshua commands the Israelites to march around Jericho not once, but seven times. And on the seventh pass around the city, with the priests still blasting away on their trumpets, the Israelites give forth a great shout. Then, in a miraculous display of God's awesome powers, the great walls of Jericho come crashing down. With the city exposed, the Israelites attack and begin the grisly task of executing God's will in their new land. Joshua 6, verse 21 tells us that the Israelites, quote, utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword, unquote. Having killed off all of Jericho's people and animals, the Israelites then loot the city of its gold, silver, and other valuables. As a finishing touch, the city of Jericho is burned to the ground. After the events at Jericho, God's people make their way through the rest of the Promised Land like a lawnmower, killing just about every man, woman, and child who had the terrible misfortune of making their home in Israel's destructive path. Joshua chapters 8 through 12 chronicle much of this destruction. We read, for example, that after the massacre at Jericho, the Israelites killed all the people living in the city of Ai. After Ai, they killed all the people living in the city of Jerusalem. After Jerusalem, they killed all the people living in the city of Hebron. After Hebron, they killed all the people living in the city of Jarmuth. And after Jarmuth, they killed all the people living in the city of Lachish. Now, they also killed all the people living in the cities of Eglon, Gezer, Deber, Horma, Arad, Libna, Adullam, Mekeda, Bethel, Tapua, Hepher, Aphek, Lasharon, Maiden, and Hazor, as well as an assortment of many other cities, the names of which I won't even try to pronounce. Joshua chapter 11, verses 12 to 15, sums up the conquest in these words. Quote, Joshua took all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. The Israelites carried off for themselves all the plunder and livestock of these cities, but all the people they put to the sword until they completely destroyed them, not sparing anyone that breathed. As the Lord commanded his servant Moses, so Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did it. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Unquote. Well, so much for proclaiming liberty throughout all the lands, huh? You know, these verses make it very clear that the genocide known as the conquest of Canaan cannot be written off as the actions of a bunch of misguided fanatics. The lines of authority are absolutely clear. God ordered this genocide. He willed it. And the Israelites, by killing these men, women, and children, were doing God's will. Like it or not, them's are the facts. Given the sheer redundancy of the violence that fills the pages of Joshua, it's easy for a reader to become desensitized to the barbarism the words are trying to convey. We must keep in mind, however, that these doomed cities didn't simply collapse by themselves in painless puffs of smoke. There was real in-your-face killing going on here. With every death, some servant of God had to ask himself the all-too-familiar question, where should I stick my sword in this one? If the Bible's telling of history is accurate, as so many people today insist that it is, then millions of human beings were intentionally massacred during this act of conquest. Incredibly, the Bible presents this wave of mass murder and looting as one of Israel's greatest achievements. Yes, these were the best of times in Israel. And as you read through the pages of the Old Testament, you can almost picture in your mind Joshua and some of his warrior buddies relaxing around the campfire after a long day of killing women and children, sipping on some ancient brew and one of them commenting, "You know, guys, it just doesn't get any better than this." Story number 5. God keeps his promise to the Amalekites. 1 Samuel chapter 15. In his best-selling book, The Moral Compass, A former drug czar and now self-anointed morality guru, William J. Bennett, shares with his readers a story we find in the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel, chapter 3. The story takes place in the days of Samuel's youth, and it tells how young Samuel is awakened one night by a voice calling his name. Samuel doesn't recognize the voice at first, but after a few more of these callings, he learns that the voice belongs to the Lord. The conversation that follows is significant because it marks the beginning of a lifelong dialogue between God and Samuel that would eventually lead to Samuel's becoming one of Israel's most famous prophets. Something else that makes this story noteworthy is the fact that no one actually gets killed in it. As I read the selection, though, I couldn't help but think to myself that were a person to venture just a few pages further in his Bible, that he would come across another story involving the prophet Samuel. Only in this story, lots of people get killed. It's a story you'd like to think would send Mr. Bennett's moral compass spinning like a top, or perhaps a roulette wheel. The story to which I refer is found in 1 Samuel chapter 15, and it takes place in the days of Saul, Israel's first king. In this story, God has once again spoken to Samuel. Only this time, God tells him to instruct King Saul to exterminate a group of people known as the Amalekites. In 1 Samuel 15, verse 3, we read, quote, "Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys," unquote. Anxious to please God and Samuel, Saul assembles an army of 210,000 men and then sets about the grisly task of doing God's bidding. And as you're no doubt beginning to realize, God's bidding very often involved the killing of children. That was most certainly the case here. For clearly, if we accept the Bible as a true book, as our friend Mr. Bennett no doubt does, then we must also accept that God has just ordered his chosen people to murder a bunch of babies. Children and infants, to use the Bible's exact words. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly how many people died in this episode of genocide, but I would imagine the number would be quite staggering in light of the fact that Saul felt the need to assemble an army of nearly a quarter of a million to accomplish the task. The casualties no doubt numbered into the hundreds of thousands. I mean, after all, how many women and children do you suppose one well-armed soldier can kill? Especially when he has God on his side. As you read through this story, you might find yourself wondering what on earth these Amalekites had done to deserve such a pounding. We find our answer in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 2, and Exodus 17, verses 8 to 16. It seems that about 400 years earlier, the Amalekites' distant ancestors had attacked the Israelites during their 40 years of wandering through the desert with Moses. This attack so infuriated God that he vowed to one day wipe the Amalekites completely off the face of the earth. God finally makes good on this promise in 1 Samuel 15. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a real problem with this. The Amalekites who originally attacked Moses and the Israelites had been dead for hundreds of years. If God was so bent on punishing those guilty of attacking Israel in the desert, then why didn't he do just that? I mean, if God had the power to part the Red Sea, to turn a man's wife into a pillar of salt, to make a donkey talk, and to kill every living thing on the planet with a flood, then neutralizing a band of desert hoodlums ought to be a piece of cake. Right? Why didn't God simply take out his wrath against those individuals who were actually responsible for the attack in the first place? According to my moral compass, it's patently immoral to murder thousands of children and infants whose only crime was that of being the distant relatives of some group of people who had attacked another group of people centuries earlier. Wouldn't that be a bit like the United States today, dropping a bunch of atom bombs on Great Britain because a couple of hundred years ago the British had attacked the American colonies? I don't know about your moral compass, but my moral compass tells me that that's just plain wrong. Perhaps Mr. Bennett would be so kind as to comment on this Old Testament story in his next best-selling book.